Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, offering financial products and services created specifically for rural America. Dedicated to helping farm families succeed with farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the first day of August 2018. I'm Todd Gleason, traveling this week in Fargo, North Dakota. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Vake. She's at Stuart Peterson. A bit later in the program, we'll take a look at the weather forecast with Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. And Scott Irwin, agricultural economist, will join us to discuss the differences between Scott Pruitt and Acting Administrator for the United States Environmental Protection Agency, Andrew Wheeler. Wheeler, by the way, was in front of a Senate committee for a hearing this morning on his priorities for the agency, and we'll hear about some of that as well on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Look us up, listen to us on demand at WILLAG.org. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago for Wednesday, September corn down 6.5 cents at $3.65¾ a bushel. December 3.80 down 6.5 and the March down 6 at 3.91. May futures 3.96½ down 5¾ and July futures in the corn pit down 5¼ at 4.01½. December of next year 4¼ lower at $4.04 a bushel. August soybeans 17¼ lower at $8.86½. The September finish down 17¾ at $8.91. November at $9 a penny and a quarter, 17¾ lower. And the January down 17½ cents at $9.12. Next year's May down 16¼ at $9.31. And July at $9.37¾ down 16½ cents. The bean oil 20 cents lower at $28.53. The bean meal down $5.60 at $3.35.60. Wheat futures soft red up 5½ at $5.59¼. The December there at $5.79½ up 6¼. And July up 5½ cents at $5.97½. Live cattle futures in Chicago, August at $108.62½ undersettled price up 95. August feeders up $2.50 at $151.82½. September at $151.95 up $2.37½. And lean hogs for the day in the August contract at $60.25 down 87½ cents. October up a nickel at $50.77½. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Here's what some of the other markets look like at this hour. Crude oil at $67.62, down $1.14 a barrel. Ethanol futures 3 cents lower at $1.42. Heating oil or diesel fuel per gallon at $2.97¢. That's down 3¢. That's actually $2.09¢. And gasoline on the RBOB at $2.04½. That's down 3½¢. Natural gas at $2.75⅝, 2¢ lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now at 25,308 is down 87 points at this hour. The U.S. dollar is up 0.105 at 94.38. And the gold futures for the afternoon are trading at $1,220.30. They're down $3.40 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like from the National Weather Service. For this evening in the Urbana-Champaign area, mostly clear, a low of 61 degrees on a south-southwest wind at 3 to 6. Tomorrow, 30% chance of rainfall, some thunderstorms after 1 in the afternoon, mostly sunny, with a high of about 85 degrees for Thursday on a south-southwest wind at 6 to 10, and partly cloudy on Thursday evening, a low of 63. That southwest wind at 5 to 7 will remain with us, though it'll calm down during the evening hours and bring us sunny skies and a high of 86 on Friday as it turns to the west-southwest at 3 to 7. Friday night, clear, a low of 66. Saturday, sunny and a high of 88. Saturday evening, clear and 68 degrees. And then for Sunday, sunny with a high of 89.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Farm Credit Illinois, a financial cooperative owned and directed by its borrower members and serving the needs of rural communities, farm families, and agriculture. Dedicated to helping farm families succeed today and tomorrow.
We're now joined by Jackie Vague. She's from Stuart Peterson to take a look at what's been happening at the CME Group in Chicago. Good afternoon to you, Jackie. Thanks for being with us.
Well, good afternoon, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
So let's go through that support and resistance set we've been doing for the last several months. What do you find now that we've had kind of some swings?
Well, it's been pretty crazy is what it's been, Todd. And I'm looking at a weekly chart, and I'm going to do something a little different. The September corn, the first support I see is at 357. Second would be 337. And major support, hopefully we never get there, is 305. Resistance, 389. Second resistance, interesting, because we have a gap that we left from June between 398 and 3/4 and $4. And then major resistance, of course, at 420 and 3/4. When you look at DEIS, first support 369, second 350, major 320. Resistance 390. We also have a gap on December between 410 and 410.5. Which was left behind in June also, and then major resistance, of course, 429.25. On beans, September, first support, 875, second, 816.25, major support, and I hope we never find this, is 721.5, resistance, 940, second resistance, 970, and major resistance up there at 1065. Now, November, first support, 881, second, 826.25, and then, again, I hope we never find this, but 736.5 is major support. Resistance is at 943, second 970, and then major resistance up at that 1060.5. You know, that 1060 area was always a really tough area for us to get through. So it's going to take, at this point, I think it might take a miracle to get that far, but you never know.
Do we know where the managed money is putting its bets today?
Well, you know, that's interesting you ask because, you know, when you look at the managed money itself, we see them long 41,000 contracts of wheat, of spring wheat, excuse me, and 61,000 of soy meal. But they're short 76,000 on corn, and that is a long ways from how short they can actually get. Short 43,000 contracts of beans, and then short 89,000 contracts of soy oil. So, you know, they are at this point in time leaning to the short side for sure when it comes to corn, beans, and soy oil.
A couple of things have been really driving the marketplace, and we'll get to the tariffs and the swings we've had in the last couple of days, but the weather forecast has really been moving the market as well. And it looks like we're going to get some hot weather, really hot weather in the Western Corn Belt.
Well, that's what they're talking about, but it's interesting. I look at it, ridge, no ridge. You know, yesterday was ridge, and we're up, up, up. Today it's no ridge. Now we're down, down, down. You know, and so this is a typical weather market for the August time frame, especially when you look at beans, because, you know, August is so extremely important, not only to corn for filling, but definitely to beans. And so I expect that we're going to continue to do these types of things. And you mentioned the trade wars. You know, of course, yesterday we heard the announcement that those products that were going to have a 10% tariff may actually go to a 25%. You know, if China does not want to come to the table, you know, so it won't go into effect this time, you know, without having a lot of feedback coming in. But, you know, it definitely shakes the market. There's absolutely no question about that.
And then how do you look at this marketplace? And maybe not for this year, but for 2019, I know that's a long ways out. And farmers have a lot to do yet with old crop and new crop corn, but maybe more hesitant. Do they need to plan further out?
Well, you know, it's hard to get people to focus on 2019. You're right, because we have so much. I mean, there's still corn not sold from, you know, this past year. There's corn that hasn't been sold yet for this year, you know. So it's just really hard to do. But at the same time, I think, you know, that they need to look at starting hedging on 2019 corn. And why is that? That's because, you know, over the years, we've had a fairly equal amount of beans and corn planted, primarily because of China's massive demands. And so if this whole thing doesn't settle itself out, I think what we'll see is we'll see more corn planted in 2019. And therefore, you know, we're above $4. That could look really, really good by the time we get into the season next year.
You've been telling us over the past couple of weeks about Dr. Cordonnier's trend lines for the states. Do we have an update from him this week?
We do, and kind of interesting, you know, we had talked about the fact that there were some of those states that were sitting at trend line that could actually move up into above trend line, and we saw that happen this week. We now have 67.5% of all the acres for corn above the trend line, 8.1 at trend line, 15.7 below trend line, and those states remain the same. They're Kansas, Missouri, North Carolina, Michigan, and Texas. I mean, we're well aware of all the problems that are in those particular states. In the trend line, we've got Colorado and South Dakota, and both of those are right on the cusp of possibly moving up into the states above trend line. And so, you know, I think that we really have to pay attention to this. When we look at the states above trend line, we've got Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, just immense amount of production states. And so it doesn't seem to be letting up. Let's just put it that way. When it comes to beans, stayed the same. 64.3% of the acres are above trend line, 16.4% are at trend line, and then 13.5% are below trend line, and those two are Kansas, Missouri, North Carolina. So, you know, it's a when we look at the at trend line in beans, we've got an opportunity. There's probably at least two of those states that may actually move up into above trend line next week, depending upon where we, you know, where we find the crop ratings to be. But it's interesting how little it's changed, you know, over, let's say, the last 4 weeks. And so to have somebody move up into above trend line, that's pretty significant. And so we'll see once. We'll look again next week as to what the projections are.
Yeah, and finally, a couple of related things on the competition side as it looks to the global market are exports. Do you think that we can get to the USDA's predicted export numbers? And on that same point, how well can Brazil compete and what kind of numbers are you watching with them?
Well, when it comes to the grain inspections, you know I watch them close, and the rail inspections to Mexico. Mexico is on, you know, on course to have a record year for importing corn from us. If they stay at that level to get to the 2.4 billion, basically we would only need about 17.4 million. That's only if Mexico stays at the rate that it's going. So I believe that it's more likely that we will make the 2.4 billion that the USDA raised exports to for corn. Now on beans, their expectation is 2.085 billion bushels. We need 31.6 million bushels a week for the last remaining 5 weeks that we have to go here yet. It can be done, you know, but it may end up not getting there, but I really think we'll be pretty darn close. And, you know, you were asking me about South America. One of the things that I think is, you know, over the last number of weeks, Todd, we've talked about, you know, the freight rates down in South America and some of the implications of that. This week they came out, Dr. Cornonier came out, and those higher freight rates, of course, are pushing up costs of production in Mato Grosso. And hang on to your socks. The cost to produce beans, if they have 45 bushel to the acre, $670 to $740. Just to produce the beans. That's not hauling them or doing anything else. If they have 50 bushel to the acre, $605 to $665. Corn, 90 bushel to the acre, $275. 100 bushel to the acre, $247. The big thing, I think the biggest fear that everybody has right now is Mato Grosso continues to only have one-third of the normal amount of fertilizer supply that they have at this time of year. And, you know, they'll start planting beans in September. They're going to have this freight situation straightened out, or it's going to be a whole different world down there compared to what we've seen before.
That, of course, is Jackie Vake. She is with Stuart Peterson. I'm Yale by Extension's Todd Gleason. Earlier today, during a U.S. Senate hearing, acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler answered questions about ethanol, biofuels, the RFS, and small refinery waivers. He appears to be holding the same line Scott Pruitt took during his time at the helm of the agency, with some notable differences. Wheeler told U.S. Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa that EPA is looking for ways to improve transparency as it's related to the issuance of small refinery waivers. It is the reallocation of the waived ethanol gallons which has raised the ire of farm country politicians. That's because EPA has seen fit not to reallocate those gallons to larger refineries. Here's a portion of the exchange between Senator Ernst and Acting Administrator Wheeler.
So if these gallons aren't reallocated somewhere, then you're not implementing the RFS in a manner that is consistent with the original intent of Congress, correct?
Well, part of the original intent of Congress was also to grant the waivers, and there was not a provision for reallocating that. We are taking a look at that issue, but we're trying to be much more clear and transparent as we grant any small refinery waivers. But as you're aware, we've been sued twice on this for not granting enough, and we've lost both times.
And I understand that. And there is also an obligation, though, of 15 billion gallons. And so those gallons that have been granted waivers for, we have to figure out a real allocation strategy.
I agree we have to figure out a real allocation strategy,
okay,
but we are confined by the law.
Ernst says some 2.25 billion gallons worth of ethanol waivers have been issued. Wheeler, like his predecessor, believes this is proper under the law, and because it isn't clearly written into the statute, does not think those waivers need to be reallocated in order to maintain the 15 billion gallon legal requirement. Iowa's Ernst also asked if EPA, in Wheeler's opinion, could grant an RVP waiver, which would clear the way for the use of higher blends of ethanol, E15, and above, year-round.
We can certainly start that process. It's, you know, as you know, Senator, there are certainly people that don't believe we have that authority. The legislation that this committee considered last year would have been very clear in giving EPA that authority. But we are looking at that issue, as you and I have discussed a few times, and happy to discuss with you further on moving forward on an RVP issue.
So a non-committal answer from Acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler testifying on the priorities of his agency. For his part, President Trump has said he supports year-round use of E15. Now, I talked earlier in the day with U of I's Scott Irwin about all of these issues and asked if he saw much of a difference between how U.S. EPA Acting Administrator Wheeler as compared to Scott Pruitt.
I think that the changes will all be in terms of style rather than substance. I don't see so far any signals that indicate any difference or any space between a Pruitt and a Wheeler-led EPA on the RFS.
One of the things that was most controversial with the agricultural industry was the Trump administration under Administrator Pruitt's leadership was using the small refineries exemption heavily. Do you think that has changed at all?
No. I think that Director Wheeler, or Acting Director Wheeler, has made it pretty clear in his public pronouncements before the hearing this morning that it will be steady as she goes regarding both the awarding of small refinery exemptions and the policy of not reallocating the small refinery exemptions to the larger refineries.
In the EPA proposal from earlier in the year for the 2019 RFS, that was clearly defined. What kind of impact does that have on use of corn?
Well, that's still up in the air. The data, if you look at different data, you can get some different clues about what's going on. I think what I'm confident in saying at this point is that to date, it's been small. I mean, it has to have some impact on ethanol usage because we've tanked D6 ethanol RIN prices, and those RINs are what provide the incentives to expand higher blends. So I think probably the best way to say it, Todd, is that the damage has been on lost potential for growth in higher ethanol blends rather than clear and obvious significant damage to the amount of ethanol that we blend in our everyday E10.
Can you square that with what has been the ethanol blend for this year? More than a million gallons a day in all except for, I believe, 2 days, according to your colleague Todd Hubbs in earlier in the week, Weekly Outlook, pinning for the Farm Doc Daily website. And what I'm really asking is, ethanol looks like it's going to meet and exceed U.S. EPA's projections for the 2018 year. However, you're telling me that there is some potential lost.
That's right. Again, we have to subdivide this very carefully, Todd, between E10, which is pretty much 10% ethanol in every gallon of gasoline in the United States now, and the market for E15 and E85, because that's the growth part of the market domestically. And again, no evidence that I've seen of major damage to ethanol use in E10. It's hard to measure because it's much, much smaller E10, E15 and E85 volumes, but I can't imagine that there hasn't been some impact on those volumes given the drop in RIN prices. But the point you're making is a really important one, is that overall, we're actually seeing some nice bullish surprises in terms of total ethanol use. So if we can kind of guess that domestic demand is flat or close to flat, the increased production, and we're not building stocks, means that we have to have a pretty robust ethanol export market right now. And that's what's really holding up total use and allowing those big weekly and monthly production figures to occur without a dramatic buildup in ethanol stocks.
And finally, how do you see the Trump administration's relationship with agriculture, of course, on trade? He has issues on the RFS and ethanol. There seems to be issues. What would you outline as what that relationship looks like and may contain going forward?
I say this, Todd, without at all meaning to be flippant, but I would say it's a complicated relationship because I think that the president maintains pretty strong political support among, corn and soybean farmers here in the U.S. Corn Belt. They generally politically tend to be a pretty conservative lot overall. And so I think that the president is maintaining support. I think that his recent move to announce the trade assistance package certainly indicates that he is sensitive to the concerns of crop farmers, and I think sincerely, personally, does admire them and wants to support them. But I've come to a different conclusion in recent weeks and months watching the Trump administration's actions on the RFS. I think consistent with his push for deregulation generally, I think it's a much underreported aspect of the Trump administration's first year and a half. I just see very little evidence that the president himself supports the RFS. I think he will say he supports ethanol, he supports farmers, and I think in his own way he means that, but I just don't see any evidence that the president really supports the RFS.
So the RFS being the legislation that underpins the ethanol industry in the United States.
That's right. I would not be surprised if we could get the president in a room and he was really honest that he would say, I love ethanol, but not the RFS.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Todd.
And that, of course, is Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's National Raspberry Cream Pie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1790, the first U.S. census was taken. We had a total of 3,939,214 mouths to feed. In 1793, France introduced the first metric weight, the kilogram. In 1817, Sir Joseph Henry Gilbert was born. Gilbert and his partner, Sir John Laws, conducted agricultural experiments at Rothamsted Experimental Station, the oldest agricultural research station in the world. They are considered founding fathers of the agricultural sciences and are also co-inventors of superphosphate fertilizer. In 1870, Ilya Ivanov was born. Ivanov, a Soviet biologist, developed the practical procedure for artificial insemination of domesticated animals. Initially used on horses, by the 1930s, the procedure was used on other farm animals. And in 1893, Henry D. Perkey and William Ford patented shredded wheat. Whole wheat is boiled, dried, pressed into thin shreds, and finally baked. They presented the product at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, Illinois, in 1893. When their patent expired in the mid-1930s, the name, shredded wheat, became generic. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is now here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hey, good afternoon to you, Drew. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Hope everything's going good wherever you may be.
Well, I'm in Fargo today and visiting my daughter all week long. However, I did not bring a coat with me, and it's cold, though I think that's going to change really fast by the weekend. Tell me about conditions that the Western Corn Belt will be under over the next several days.
Yeah, absolutely. There was actually a little frost this morning in patches across northeastern parts of crop country in Saskatchewan and northwestern Manitoba. So temperatures did get down into some 40s in the eastern Dakotas and Minnesota this morning, and even cooler to the north. But it is coming to an end. A massive high-pressure area off to the west that has produced daily highs in the 90s to over 100 degrees in the Pacific Northwest over the past couple of weeks is working its way eastward now. And by the time we get to the weekend, the heat will have expanded across all of the northern plains. It'll actually begin a lot sooner than that. Montana will already be near and over 100 degrees tomorrow afternoon. And we'll see the temperatures getting into the 90s to near 100 in the Dakotas on Friday. Over the weekend, we'll see the heat trying to work further to the east. Now, the good thing for the Midwest is concerned is that there's going to be a new cool front coming out of Canada that will limit the duration of the heat in the eastern parts of the country. So the Midwest will see a notable warming trend on Saturday and Sunday, and it will linger maybe into Monday, but a cool air mass will come in behind that and bring those temperatures back into a little bit more of a seasonably warm range. We'll still have temperatures that will get into the 90s, though, across parts of the Western Corn Belt in particular, just ahead of a line of thunderstorms and somewhat cooler weather. So it's going to be bearable for the Midwest. The Northern Plains, unfortunately, are going to see a lot more heat as we go through next week.
So is this part of the oscillation that we sometimes talk about during the summertime, and is it going to be pushed to the west again by this cool front, and do you expect it to turn back east, or is it a different function?
Actually, I think we will see some bouncing around. Most of the long-term model data suggests that we should have a mean ridge position over the high plains region for the duration of the summer. So most of August should put the average location for that ridge to run from West Texas up into eastern portions of Montana and the western Dakotas. So those areas out there in the high plains region will indeed see additional hot weather all month long. But the ridge is going to move around a little bit at times. So we'll get it into the western Corn Belt once in a while, and then it'll be forced back to the west every once in a while as well when we get some cooler air coming down the front side of the ridge. So, yeah, it is going to move around, and that's good news because when it moves around like that, we usually get enough variety in our weather for crops to handle the situation as well as possible. And we will see some brief periods of rainfall in between the warm and dry periods as well. So most likely the southwestern Corn Belt that's already suffering from so much dryness will continue doing so. But that's probably the only area in the Midwest proper that is going to be seeing ongoing stressful conditions.
Hey, Drew, thanks so much.
You bet. Have a great day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner. He's with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media's Public Radio for the Farming World. Find us online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.